Quite a hazy meditation. Oh, sorry.
So the whole point of this path is the connection. It's the fundamental place in the tree of life where opposites connect. But it also takes us into the fundamentals of life, because this is the place where the two become the three, and therefore form the generative units of one, two, and three. Whenever you get two, there's always a third term in order to stabilize or to enable further kind of growth. In order for that growth then to become stable, it becomes four. In order for that fourness to acquire motion, it becomes five. The motion of the five then generates that sense of creating a reflective center, which becomes six. That stability of the six then multiplies to become seven. The multiplicity of the seven is then balanced by the repeating cycles of the eight, which generate then a sense of density and image in the nine, and then express themselves as the tenfold expression. So these are the spheres, really these are the spheres of the tree of life. This, if you like, underneath kind of shaping of energy and creativity. We begin with the center point, the single point, the smooth point of Ketta, that is the position in space. It moves there to reflection, to becoming the line. And then in the third term, the number three, it becomes the surface. The four becomes the solid. Five, the solid in motion. Six is the reflection on motion. Seven, the multiplication of the energy of energies. The prismatic, if you like, splitting of the single light into the multiple colors, which is then balanced by the reverberations of the cycling of the eight, which then, and the combination of the multiplying energies combined with the repetitive reverberations of the eight, creates the image, which is icon or idol, depending on its reference point. And then as that image comes into manifestation, then we get the ten, we get the world, the substantial world we know and think and act in. So the whole of the tree of life really comes out of these, the numbers 1 to 10. And within those numbers, there are three paths in particular that are the three girder points of the tree that hold the different energies of the tree together. The first, of course, is the path between Netzach and Hod, between the sense of the feelings, feeling energy of life, the thinking energy of life. And and the Hebrew letter that applies to that path is the letter Pei, which is the speaking of the embodied word. It also has the tarot trump, the tower attached to it, because it is both the breaking down and the building up of the house of life. The second girder path really is the one between Gedula and Geburah, between compassion and mercy, and between severity and challenge and clarity. And here, the path here is the Hebrew letter Tet, which is the serpent, which is the energy that can both create and entrap. And the tarot card that applies here is the Tower of Force, where you have the image of the woman opening the jaws of the lion. And now in the first girder path, you're dealing with the place of structure, of what happens to the structures of self, the falling down of the house of life and the rebuilding of that. So that's the territory of that path. The territory of the middle girder path between Gedula and Geburah is to do with the energy of creation, and to do with the balance of mercy and expansion and severity and constriction. In this path, this is the root. This girder path is the root of all the other girders. We have the image of the Empress. We have the Hebrew letter Dalet. We have the fusion of will and love, and the generation of life, and the sense of here are the root archetypes. Here is the divine imagination, the deep imagination of the soul, and the deep will of the soul. Now, in the meditations that we have done today, we have been looking at this, both this sense of trusting the imagination, working with the imagination, taking us beyond our normal kind of limits. In the first meditation, the practice is the yearning, the return to the garden. So we have this sense of taking our shape in a different way, becoming the living hallows of the Grail, and following the longing for that place that is beyond opposites, the place that is like paradise, the place that feels like true home. And so we go on this very classic Western kind of journey to the Isles of the Blessed, to the Isles of the West. This is called the Irish call this the Imrama, the sea journey, the journey into the deep places of the spirit. And so we encounter in the beginnings of that first meditation today, we encounter the figure of Gawain, who holds within himself all the mysteries of the Arthurian tradition, having passed through it all. We then encounter the old sea harbour, the place of that you would set off from. To find the Isles of the Blessed. And of course in our time this harbour is neglected, is in ruins, no one lives there. But we go across the sea, we come to the transitional island in the midst of the sea, through which we can glimpse the holy place, the place beyond opposites. And in that journey, as we travel, and it's kind of like the art and the tree of life, so we come into that mysterious kind of place following the white path, which now is a clear path, a stable path, that takes us into the mystery of the cottage, which is the cottage that contains all the saving and resurrecting stories. And on the one side of the cottage, we have the great white lilac tree, the flowering tree, which can represent life and that kind of whiteness, and all the many colours come out of whiteness. On the other side, we have the great yew tree, that is both the immortal tree and the tree that is poisonous and associated with death and churchyards. So the shape them in the cottage itself is a kind of miraculous place. It's thatched with straw of silver and gold. It has within that the kind of memory of the things you get in fairy stories of Rumpelstiltskin weaving straw into gold. The stone of the cottage is a white stone, but veined with silver and gold, veined with the opposites, with the sun and the moon. So we're in this magical kind of cottage, fairy tale cottage, literally. And as we enter into the fairy tale cottage, we're given a carved candle holder that is formed of our capacity to hold the light. And as we take up our own light, we see there's lots of other people in there, all, each with their own candle holder. And then we go from that room, after we hear this great gong sound, which then summons us down a corridor, past tapestries of many, many stories. And we come into the room of story, sit at the fire with the storyteller, where we have these strange resinous pine logs that fill the air with pine scent, and that burn with a silver and gold flame and are never consumed. And as we contemplate that fire, as we listen to the storyteller, we're taken on the journey that is the straight path. A straight path that goes along green banks on either side, trees above us, and to a gateway of silver and gold, with silver and gold trees intertwining together. And as we go through that, we go into mystery. Now, the second journey we did today is different. We go to an actual place. We go to the Royal Rite Stones up in Oxfordshire. And here we encounter the Hallows in a different way. Here we are challenged by the guardian of the Hallows and we are asked to give something up. The path of the sword is always a path of sacrifice, a path of surrendering something in order for something else to emerge. And as we do that, we become one with the circle of stones, one of the king's men, in that sense. And by entering that circle, we enter then into an unfolding mystery of the Hallows. So our next encounter is the King's Stone, and with all those who stand in that place of sovereignty through the generations. So we become one who bears the spear, bears the rod, bears that sense of the consecrated will. Having aligned with that, we then go to the Whispering Nights, we go to the great tomb, the great place, the cave of the mother. This is the place of the Grail Hallow, the place of the cup cauldron. And again, we enter into a mystery. We enter into the experience of being remade, reborn. Next, we are, as we emerge from it, we find ourselves back in the circle, but it's different, back before standing outside the circle in a different place, because we have changed and therefore everything has changed. And we're confronted by a guardian who holds out this polished shield-like stone. And we are asked, will you be one with we? Absolute choice. Will you be one? Will you be part of this unfolding mystery? Now, if you choose that, you find yourself then inside the circle differently. Now, as someone who is part of the mystery, not seeking the mystery. So the sword is in your hand, the cup is in your heart. The circle of stones are in your bones. The rod is in your spine. You become the living embodiment of the mystery and the guardian of that mystery. And then you're just here. And in a sense, that place of being just here, being the, in a way, what happens to them, to Malchut on the Tree of Life, when we are able to do that and embody that, is Malchut takes its place as Da'at. And in a sense, the rest of the tree is absorbed then into that mystery, because the triangles of the tree will fold themselves inwards. So what we're left with is a quaternity that is formed out of Kheta. Hokma, Bina, Malchut Da'at. Malchut. So a Malchut becomes Da'at. Okay. So that the tree folds inwards into the simplicity of the mystery. So our body is the vehicle of mystery, the vehicle both of the non-dual will, the non-dual imagination, the non-dual presence of Kheta. So when we stand in that place, metaphorically, holding the sword before the circle, being the embodiment of the mystery, our job is to manifest the mystery, to protect the mystery, to tend the mystery. Not as an act of doing, but as an experience of our being. Well, it's really our sense of self alters. So the sense of being present in the world, being present really as as the vehicle of a mystery, is to feel that sense of deep presence, will, imagination, and embodiment, so that in any of our conversations. You know, conversations are just ordinary, normally, with people. Can I buy that, please? How much is that? And it's not that that alters. You behave entirely normally in the world. You're not running around trying to initiate people. But by your sense of connection with that deeper place, ordinary things become infused with something much deeper. So I buy something, we have some contact with each other, something happens in that contact, it might be a smile, it might be just a glance at me, but something happens. So the reality of the manifestation of mystery is not running around waving swords and wands, but it's the embodiment of the principles represented by these images. And that can happen in so many different ways, really. I mean, it can happen in groups like this, it can happen by pieces of art, pottery, but of course it can happen just in ordinary conversations and just doing very, very ordinary things. It really is the sense of the universe, the unity of the universe, the one and the many, the particular and the universal being at one. Now the other thing that's interesting really about these girder paths is they're always in tension with a vertical path. So the vertical path really that's there that comes down from Kheta down to Tiferet is the path of Gimel, the path of the camel, which is the path of the experience of the non-dual presence coming directly into the presence of the heart. So when we're in this, these Gurdwara paths always have this kind of fourfold aspect somewhere. So we're combining, of course, Bina and Hokma, but also the sense of Kheta and Tiferet. Now, Tiferet is the revealer of Kheta. It's the heart presence that then manifests through thought and feeling and image and action. So as we bring ourselves into that place of the opposite and of being the vehicle of the mystery, what happens is our heart is also infused with that deep non-dual presence of Kheta, which infuses our thoughts, our feelings, our images and our actions.
Can I just ask something?
Yeah.
So, the image that comes to me is somewhere like we are dipped, I guess, we are like a swimming pool. We are dipped in this tree, balanced tree, and we, as if we come from that place. The Andy Smith is not so present. It's, that's what's happening.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, completely. So Alilia Smith is there, but not as, that's a nice way to put it, not as there, because this other is coming through Alilia Smith as well. So the sense of identity is more fluid, it's larger and more fluid, and less contracted.
So the next question is that, sort of say, will that vertical movement, I can use it in words to say, will that digest the Andy Lee Smith personality?
It'll that's an interesting word, digest. In a way, yes. What it does is to augment the Andy Lee Smith personality, and enable that personality to take her place within a larger space, within a larger form. So you don't stop being Andy, but Andy is identifiably Andy, but is a bigger Andy, a more relaxed Andy, a more fluid Andy, enjoying being Andy. Without some of the, we all have in our personality of all these knots and contractions, right? So what happens is that larger energy smooths that out, takes that up into a larger kind of form, because our particularity is needed. So it's not that we vanish, our personalities never vanish. This is where it takes me back to my Ram Dass story, who kind of never loses a single one of his. Ram Dass's description of this is really helpful to me, because it shows, I think, what happens as a result of this work. So we don't lose our neuroses, we don't lose, but they become little guys, they become befriended, they become simply part of us and not major obstacles to that transmission of the light. In fact, they become the vehicle through which that inner light can manifest.
It comes back into the bundle of the living.
Yes, exactly. It's included. Yes, that's another good way to put it. Because it's included, because that sense of separation, so much of our difficulty in our personalities are these places where we feel alone and separated and lost. So that sense where we feel included and loved and held by that deeper kind of presence enables those little parts of ourselves to relax and to sort of woof, just to be part of things, rather than feel in an isolated and lost place. So even then, our apparent stucknesses, our apparent difficulties, are at the service of a deeper life.
Could that be why, something to do with why I feel so disconnected today? It's because it's like I don't know where I am in it all. And is it to do with coming into something different, the letting go and
Yes, I think, well, it definitely could be that, couldn't it? Because that's what we're concentrating on, this particular path. So we're concentrating on something that actually this breaks down our normal sense, a normal way of thinking about ourselves and thinking about the world. Because we're looking at this sense of the connected world, and that sense of being bigger and more connected and more held than we normally expect to feel. So it definitely could be that, Jenny. It could certainly be that. And I think what's important in that, if you're feeling disconnected, is not to be worried about that. Okay? Is to include that sense of feeling disconnected. Just to think, that's just to be interested in that. Okay, we're doing this, I feel really disconnected. And so instead of being worried about that or thinking there's something wrong in that, trying to trust that. Mm. So letting yourself be here, be fully here and fully disconnected. Mm. And then it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that, I think. And I think that's the point somewhere about all the, that's the point about our particularity being very important. So it isn't about getting rid of chunks of ourselves so that then there's some shining angelic kind of rather bland figure behind that. Right, it is actually that our particular nature is needed. So our particular difficulties are, now, you know, those of us as a therapist will really know this, because actually, a regular experience for me when I'm practicing as a therapist is the way in which the people who come to me mirror my own struggles in my life. And that mirroring, that provides us with contact. If I couldn't mirror that, if I couldn't connect to their struggle, it wouldn't be much good for them as a therapist, because we would be strangers to each other. And the whole nature of psychotherapy is the development of a particular kind of intimacy where somebody discovers they are not alone, and there is a possibility to be held in places that have felt lost and isolated. So that's where our particular, the thing we think of as our difficulties is actually then at the service of that deeper sense of healing. So it means, in a sense, that our personalities are needed. Our personalities are not a mistake. You know, when we're struggling with the parts of ourselves that we struggle with, it's very easy, of course, to feel that, because you get a bit fed up with yourself. But of course, it's a completely understandable feeling. But actually, there is no place really where we're just going to vanish and become some kind of. I mean, I think one of the great oppressive things around spirituality is the idea that we, our personalities vanish. We become this all loving, all kind of kind, all kind of wise, kind of person, untouched by anything, normally. You know, it's a horrific kind of fascist image of a human being somewhere. You know, so it's not human. You know, it's a chilling in some ways. And in a way, when you encounter, there are people who will try and get you to, in the service of spirituality, try and get you to not feel things anymore. Where if you're expressing feeling, you're somewhere wrong. You're somehow a bit coarse and a bit sort of. And whereas actually the. And I think of the handful of people I've known in my life who I think really are very spiritually advanced. Their capacity for presence is enormous. Their capacity, therefore, to feel and to be touched by the world is huge. So there's also the genuine, if you like, capacity that emerges out of this work is not that kind of detached spiritual master who just says wise things, but actually someone who has the capacity to enter into your experience with you through an act of vulnerability. And that's really where this work takes us in that sense.
I particularly liked in the challenge when we gave something that was a sacrifice in some part of ourselves. I was telling you that was drawn out with the point of the sword.
Yeah, okay.
Sort
yeah,
of change.
Yeah.
And then it was given back. So it was still me, and I still have the same things, but in a changed form.
That's right, yeah. Really yeah. No. No, that's that whole practice. I mean, that with the hallow of the sword. So it is often called the sword bridge. And they have this rather painful image of walking the bridge of a sword. And because there is a, in the encounter with the sword hallow, which is all about transition and the new emerging through the giving up of something. And that peculiar thing that actually what you think is lost is returned in a new way. So that great phrase in the worldwide ritual, taken, tendered, taken, returned, is a real kind of image of that kind of repetition of something being given away and something being given back. Taken, turned, and...
I find it really difficult doing that surrender, because I was thinking, I could surrender my house or my savings. So I did give him a bit of my heart.
Right, good.
Okay, but I thought that wasn't really enough.
No. That's always the interesting thing. That you see, because actually the whole point about that giving is you give what you can give. Right. So whatever you give, it has to be authentic. So and then of course, you know, there's the judgy part of ourselves that will say, oh, hang on a minute, really, you shouldn't have done that very well, did you? But that's normal. You know, the whole point about that turning is whatever is given. So I could give my house, no, don't want to do that. Money, no, don't want to do that. I could give part of my heart. Okay, that's real. So then that becomes a real thing. And a real exchange happens there. And what comes out of that, we'll see. But you know, that's the, you know, it's not about grand gestures, this at all. Mm. That's the important thing, you know, it's sort of...
mine was really mundane, because I keep a penknife in my pocket. Mm-hmm. It was my penknife, but it's like, it's not that special, is it? It was very clear, you handed over a penknife.
Was there, what did you call it?
Not even great sentimental
value. Sacrifice, was it?
Yeah, sacrifice.
So that's a big word in my book.
Yeah. Well, it's a big word in our culture, isn't it? So, you know, and it has it has connotations of Christ's sacrifice, and the, you know, culturally, that's the thing, give everything away. And, it, you know, it's a, you know, and, you know, people can do exaggerated things like that. But actually, the point about a true sacrifice, if it is given away as a gesture, it's not real. Mm. Actually, what's given away has to be given away without thought of return, without the feeling of I'm making a big gesture, aren't I brilliant? So you give. So that's why to give what you can give, to trust what emerges in that moment, is actually kind of quite important.
Could I ask about the tree folding in on itself?
Yep.
I don't know if I've gone into a misconstruing that, but I'm just interested, does the tree fold in on Da'at, and so Da'at becomes the kind of mystery place which enfolds the whole tree, which it can grow from,
yes,
to, so that's.
Yeah. So what happens, we could look at it in stages, and I perhaps will later on, but just essentially what happens is that as we enter into this, if you imagine Malkut then coming into the place of Da'at, so everything returns into Da'at. So then the rest of the tree is held within the mystery. So all the qualities of the other Sephirot, instead of being more fixed in form, manifest according to the appearance of the mystery through Da'at, right? So that sense of the presence of Keter, the awareness of Keter, the non-dual will and the non-dual imagination and love of Bina, constantly embodying itself in whatever way and form. So the rest of the tree appearing spontaneously and then just vanishing back again into the mystery. It is going and returning. It is exactly that. So that's the simplicity that you come to. I mean, in a more gradual way, you can see what happens, right? So we start off, we've got this sense of this vertical tree. So up here is somewhere very kind of high and spiritual. Down here, there's us sitting in Malkut, and there's various intermediate places. Right, so as in a certain sense, what happens to us as we engage with the Tree of Life, as we become aware first of all of the lower triangle, so first of all, we just establish ourselves in our body. We then become aware of the lower triangle of Netzach, Hod, and Yesod. So we become aware of the world of the imagination, the world of thinking and feeling. As we start to deepen into the tree and connect Tiferet, Gedulah, and Geburah, So what starts to happen is the tree starts to grow together. So in a certain sense, Yesod starts to become more connected to Tiferet. Geburah to Hod, Gedulah to Netzach. So if in a certain sense you could say our thinking becomes taken up into clarity, our feeling taken up into that expressive, compassionate love. Our sense of our turbulent imagination rises up into the sense of heart presence. So that's if you like the first folding. It's almost like the tree stepping up and the Gedulah, Geburah absorbing Hod and Netzach, and Yesod coming into Tiferet. Now the next stage that happens is Geburah and Gedula being absorbed into Chokmah and Bina. The Tiferet and Yesod place coming into the mystery of the art. Malchut then is in Tiferet. And then the final thing that happens is that Malchut becomes one with Tiferet Yesod in the art. And so the whole tree is like telescopes down into these four spheres. And then can come out of that again, really. Yeah, so basically it's like Keter, Chokmah, Bina, and then this complex of, it's Malchut really, but Malchut contains within it, it's Malchut in the art in Malchut. So it's it's the mysterious aspect of body. So in a certain sense, you know, if we come to the notion of the hallows for a moment, we have the sense of the stone hallow in Malchut. We have the cup hallow in Bina. We have the spear and rod hallow in Chokmah. The sword is Keter. And so that's it's that ultimate constellation. And that these four hallows, these four spheres, are the four cities of Gorias, Murias, Phineas, Phalias. They are the true home, in a sense. Gorias, the city of the east of the sword, Murias, the city of the cup and the west, Phineas, the city of the spear and the south, Phalias, the city of the stone and the north.
Where are they from, Ian?
They're from Irish tradition. They're from the Book of Invasions. I think it's probably the Book of Invasion. So they were the four cities of the Tuatha De Danann, the fairy people of Ireland, really.
The Book of Invasion.
And they are.
I think they're in the Book of Invasion. I'll have to look that up because I can't quite remember.
They embody the qualities of the archangels as well.
Well, of course, yes, the archangels are also that. So the. So if you were laying the archangels over this, you'd have the Uriel in the Malchut place, Raphael in the Keter, Gabriel in Bina, and Mikael in Chokmah.
And the fourth tarot.
And the fourth sides of the tarot, of course, are in there as well, yeah. Let's have a break for a cup of tea. And then we'll come back.